Welcome to Frankly Judaic, a podcast that explores cutting-edge Judaic studies research conducted at the University of Michigan. I'm your host, Jeremy Shear.
My grandfather was, as you could say, a refugee of World War II from Poland. And the way that he got to the United States was actually his family was in Poland. They went to Lithuania and they got visas from the Japanese consul, the Chune Sugihara. And he was illegally stamping Jewish visas so that Jews in Lithuania could get to Japan before the Nazis started sending people to the camps.
This is Zoya Brumberg-Kraus, an independent scholar and a fellow at the Frankel Center for Advanced Judaic Studies at the University of Michigan. As Brumberg-Kraus mentioned, her grandfather and his family got their visas from Chune Sugihara, a Japanese diplomat based in Lithuania who, much like the more famous Oskar Schindler in Germany, went out of his way to save Jews by issuing them transit visas so they could escape the Nazis by fleeing to Japan.
And my grandfather and his parents got these Sugihara visas. They went to Japan. They were there for a couple of months, and then they came to California via Angel Island in San Francisco. So opposite migration than we're typically used to when it comes to Jewish immigrants, whether refugees, immigrants, usually they're coming over the Atlantic.
They eventually made their way to Los Angeles.
Because my great-grandfather had a job teaching Yiddish at a school, a Yiddish school or after-school program, something like that in Boyle Heights, which my grandfather always referred to as Brooklyn Heights. I'm not sure if it was actually referred to as Brooklyn Heights in that moment, but the main drag was Brooklyn Avenue, and now it's Cesar Chavez.
Brumberg-Kraus's grandfather and his family eventually relocated to New York, but their sojourn in California became a point of fascination for Brumberg-Kraus. While working on her PhD dissertation about the built environment in California and the influence of Spanish, Moorish, Chinese, and Japanese influence on the architecture, the COVID-19 pandemic forced many sites to close, in turn forcing Brumberg-Kraus to change her plans. While staying in Boyle Heights in L.A., her grandfather's old stomping grounds many decades ago, Brumberg-Kraus became fascinated by how much that area had changed.
I think it's University of Southern California recently did kind of interesting project on unveiling Jewish Boyle Heights and came at this from a different angle, looking at fine architecture, Richard Neutra's atelier, and a Jewish architect, Rafael Soriano, who did some work for the Jewish community. And I found out through this other project that actually the Jewish community center that he built, this modernist center, was in Boyle Heights, where my grandfather lived, and that they taught Yiddish classes there.
Brumberg-Kraus wondered, could this have been where her great-grandfather taught Yiddish?
It might have been, it might not have been. There were other sites that did that. Just going from there and looking at, okay, this is the building where, you know, the Arbiter Ring or the Workmen's Circle was meeting. This is where the International Workers Organization hosted I Am an American Day. And then I started having these memories of my grandfather talking about how at his school they would all say, I am an American, because so many people were immigrants. And I started making these connections, and it really informed the way that I pursued my research from that point onwards.
Specifically, Brumberg-Kraus began looking at how neighborhoods change from Jewish to Japanese to African American and so on.
I'm looking at just how people interacted, what kind of spaces that different communities interacted with each other, and this has gotten a little bit away from my Zadie, but that's, I was just having really this experience of thinking about, as I moved through Los Angeles, is the city that, even though it's a relatively young city by global standards and even by American standards, it already has these layers of lives that were there before even the research that I started.
Brumberg-Kraus's current book project focuses on West Coast architecture, specifically buildings built or repurposed by Jews and other minorities, as a vernacular medium through which people express and construct their identities and present them publicly.
So not necessarily the design itself, but what people did with the design, how they collaborated with architects, or how they inherited other buildings and changed their functions and made it their own. So that's very abstract. But in a concrete sense, I have a few different case studies in San Francisco and Los Angeles where I'm looking at specific buildings.
In this episode, we take a close look at two examples of buildings in San Francisco and Los Angeles that demonstrate how Jews use these structures to say something about their hybrid Jewish and American identities, and how they were influenced by other immigrant groups, Chinese and Japanese in particular, engaged in similar projects. During the 1890s, as pogroms in Eastern Europe made life there untenable for Jews, more and more Jews immigrated to the United States, many settling in New York's Lower East Side, and some, like Brumberg Krause's grandfather, in West Coast cities such as Los Angeles and San Francisco. The established Jewish communities in these places, who'd come from Western European countries and over the decades had become more or less fully Americanized, looked down on the new arrivals as ghetto Jews. In fact, the East European immigrants were generally impoverished, spoke Yiddish, and needed help to assimilate and learn the ways of their new home. In San Francisco, leaders of the Jewish community created settlement houses to that end.
So what are settlement house programs? They're things that help immigrant women become Americans. So they were things like cooking classes, English classes, physical fitness, the physical culture movement. So like swimming and weightlifting, dancing, folk dancing, education, sewing, like how to be a good wife type classes. But because it was a Jewish organization, there was also a lot of Jewish education and just literary clubs, things that I think are important to Jewish communities even as early as 1906, 1908.
One such settlement house, the Emmanuel Sisterhood Residence Club, provided housing and vocational training for Jewish female immigrants. By the mid-1920s, the demand for housing was so great that the Sisterhood decided to build a new facility that could accommodate around 70 women. To design the building, they turned to famed female architect Julia Morgan.
She was the first woman to graduate from the Beaux-Arts Institute in Paris. No men would employ her at their ateliers, so she couldn't get the hours that she needed to be licensed, and it took a long time for her to get where she was. She's most known actually for designing San Simeon, so the Hearst Castle, but she also designed, I think, most of the Mills College campus, a lot of UC Berkeley. She is kind of the resident architect for the Hearst family, but she also had this ongoing relationship with women's organizations, and particularly a Young Women's Christian Association, and designed a lot of buildings for them.
When San Francisco's male Jewish architects expressed displeasure that the job was given to a woman, and a non-Jewish woman at that, it was decided that the job would go to one of Morgan's employees, a young Jewish architect named Dorothy Wormser. The building that Wormser helped design was more than just a rooming house.
There was a large recreation center, a large dining room. I think there was a small kind of gymnasium exercise area in the basement. And it was a very beautiful building for these women who had previously been, you know, the women who lived there. It housed, I think, 64 women, so double what they could house before. And they had their own rooms. Some of them had their own bathrooms. Some had shared bathrooms. They had shared kitchens, shared socializing facilities, closets, desks, work areas.
The building featured a red brick exterior surrounded by neoclassical columns. It also had a courtyard with a fountain. The only explicitly Jewish part of the design was a fence that featured Stars of David worked into the lattice above the building's front entrance. And in this sense, it was similar to another building designed by Julia Morgan, the Chinese Association YWCA.
The Chinese Association YWCA was also this brick building with a kind of Renaissance revival look to it, but then it had all these accents of, I'd say, more both traditional and contemporaneous Chinese architecture. Julia Morgan studied Chinese architecture, and she sourced a lot of the materials from merchants and artisans in Chinatown.
Looking at the buildings together, Brumberg-Kraus says, provides insight into how the women who ran the Emanuel Sisterhood and the Chinese Association understood their missions to help acculturate female immigrants without erasing their backgrounds.
Another thing that really strikes me is this idea of a type of architecture that's indigenous to San Francisco, in that it's this very particular brick style, but functional. It's earthquake proof and fireproof and fairly cost effective. Both of these buildings were designed to fit in their surroundings well, while also having these markers of like ethnic cultural identity.
It's worth noting, Brumberg-Kraus says, that while the exteriors of these buildings were designed to fit in with their surroundings, the interior spaces housed a mix of events and activities that fostered Americanization while at the same time blending in ethnic cultural markers. For example, the Emanuel Sisterhood organization published a cookbook featuring recipes for Jewish foods made with American ingredients, such as canned foods. Both the Sisterhood residence and the Chinese Association YWCA had exercise and social event spaces that enabled Jewish and Chinese immigrant women to participate in activities that would not have been possible or allowed in the countries and patriarchal traditions from which they came.
That was the case for all of these different groups of immigrant women, is that on the one hand, these programs of Americanization sought to remove women from their cultural context, and there were programs of assimilation. And I think that each of these buildings tell us a different story, which is that these women were taking the aspects of Americanization that worked for them to help them live fuller lives without giving up on their cultural identities.
Probably seen pictures of the famous Grauman's Chinese Theater in Los Angeles, or at least you've likely heard of it, and of the handprints, footprints, and other prints of Hollywood celebrities embedded in the concrete of the theater's courtyard. But you may not know much about the theater's original owner, Sid Grauman.
Sid Grauman came to California, the San Francisco Bay Area, at first through the gold rush. His father followed these gold rushes, not necessarily as a prospector, but as producing vaudeville and minstrel shows at these mining camps.
During the 1915 Panama Pacific International Exposition in San Francisco, Grauman opened an exhibition he called Slumming Chinatown.
He later changed the title to Go Slumming because the Chinese community told him, you can't do this. So he had this exhibition at the World Fair with a fake Chinatown where people would go into it and they would see these wax figures and actors pretending to be prostitutes and opium dens and gambling dens. And it was like a fake slumming tour. And this was in 1915, at a moment when Chinatown really wasn't like that. It was Sid Grauman kind of playing off of people's racism and curiosity and presenting this as a form of entertainment for not so high class people.
A few years later, Grauman moved to Los Angeles, where he opened several movie palaces, including the Million Dollar Theater, which opened in 1918, and the Egyptian Theater, which opened in 1922. Grauman's next and last theater, the Chinese Theater, opened in 1927. The design featured elements that Grauman borrowed from the Chinese theaters he visited in San Francisco.
And he did this in a moment when the movie palace was this craze across the United States. And in San Francisco Chinatown, there were these small, you could call them Chinese theaters, there were also Chinese opera houses, which had designs somewhat similar to what Sid Grauman uses in his Chinese theater. And actually, one of these theaters, I think it was the Shanghai Theater, was run by Benjamin Michaels, who also collaborated with Grauman on his World Fair atrocity.
For Brumberg Kraus, Grauman's theater is an example of how Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe who became wealthy, such as Grauman, tried to distance themselves from the masses of poor Jewish immigrants who were sometimes described in derogatory terms as Asiatic mongrels. Grauman built the Chinese theater, and in fact designed his professional and personal life, as a way to more firmly establish himself as American, in contrast to the less acculturated Jewish and Chinese immigrants in California.
He found a sort of comfortable space of being a Jewish American by differentiating himself from Chinese immigrants and other Jewish immigrants, and this kind of anti-East world of immigration, anti-immigration legislation and Asian exclusion, Chinese exclusion. But he also saw a beauty to the particularities of San Francisco and this kind of Chinese American hybrid culture. And he presented that in a way that was very public, that made this mark in Hollywood and inspired these Chinatown designs that were by Chinese Americans.
Brumberg Kraus hopes that her book will help readers become more aware of the stories that buildings and spaces can tell about the people who built them and how they thought about themselves and about the communities of which they were a part.
What I'm trying to get people to think about in reading this book is to not take for granted the spaces that we interact with all the time, but rather think about what are the histories embedded in this place? What can I learn from being here? What can I not learn from being here? What might have been left out from the story of why this neighborhood or this building or this aesthetic is here today, and others are not?
You've been listening to Frankly Judaic, a production of the Gene and Samuel Frankel Center for Judaic Studies at the University of Michigan. The podcast is produced by Conversa. The executive producer is Maya Barzilai. You can find and subscribe to Frankly Judaic anywhere you get podcasts. And if you like the show, please give it a 5-star review. Thanks for listening.